Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And once again, apologies about the slightly more infrequent podcast at the moment. But as I mentioned previously, post-viral, post-COVID exhaustion has got the better of me ever so slightly. But we'll labour on together. So tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about the attempts by the British to stem the tide of African nationalism in what is now Zambia and Zimbabwe, in northern and southern Rhodesia and Nyasaland, which is now Malawi, and the creation of the Central African Federation. So this is really the story of Britain's attempts to maintain its empire in Africa during the 1950s. The 1940s had seen the end of empire for the most part in Asia, the loss of India, which is everything from Pakistan to Burma, and the abandonment of Palestine. The 1950s had seen the kind of the epic humiliation of the Suez Crisis, and throughout the 1950s, from 1951 through to 1959, and there's a reason why we're going to use those two kind of historical bookends. The British tried to hold on to and to stem the tide of nationalism in Central Africa, and we will look at other parts of British Africa later on. The British had obviously, from the 1880s onwards, colonised most of Africa from Cairo to the Cape. They had a huge swathe of territory down East Africa. However, the jewel in the crown of the empire, as it was kind of famously referred to, was always India. India was worth far more to the British, or had been up until the 1940s, than most of the British holdings in Africa. As we'll see, there becomes a kind of a three-way struggle between the British authorities in Africa, the British imperial authorities, the African nationalist parties and movements, but also a white settler class that was not going to cooperate with even the most modest moves towards self-rule, even if that meant maintaining part of the empire, maintaining the colony within within the empire itself. And we see, when we talked a while back about French colonists in Vietnam, this vociferous and utterly unyielding stance came from those white settlers, French in the case of Vietnam, British in the case of the Central African Federation, who believed themselves, who convinced themselves that they were natives in the land. Some had been born in Africa and in Vietnam, and saw themselves as being the rightful owners of the land. And they began to see themselves as having perhaps less to do with the colonial metropole, France or Great Britain. And they saw the cause of their continued colonial rule, partly as a matter of white supremacy, partly as a matter of their own sense of entitlement and their right to rule. And they actually began to see the colonial metropole, the mother country, if you will, as being more of a nuisance and a hindrance, something eventually to be defied, as we shall see in the character of Ian Smith in Rhodesia when we come across him. So, once again, we're looking at the brilliant work of Martin Thomas in Fight or Flight, and he begins by talking about the Conservative Party that ruled throughout most of the 1950s. He writes, "There's a case, so far as the halting strides of British decolonisation are concerned, for thinking of a short 1950s, bookended by the election victory of Winston Churchill's Conservatives in October 1951, and the appointment of the reformer Ian MacLeod as Harold Macmillan's colonial secretary in October 1959. Over the intervening 8 years, three successive Conservative governments courted their favoured nationalist collaborators and picked fights with others they deemed too radical. British military force and covert interventions were used with seeming abandon, not as a last resort, but as the first to restore the Shah of Iran in 1953, to prevent left-wing victory in Latin America, the Latin American colony of British Guyana in that same year, and more generally, to ramp up counterinsurgency efforts in Malaya, Kenya and Cyprus. In this sense, the attempt to overthrow Egypt's Colonel Nasser in November 1956 fitted a broader trend. Certain Conservative ministers were also willing to defend white settler privilege in southern Africa in a way that their Labour opponents found increasingly repugnant." So when we're talking about the Central African Federation of Southern Rhodesia and the protectorates of Northern Rhodesia and Nyasaland, it's difficult to untangle and to separate out two differing tendencies that the British had. The first was to give up on their colonies as too difficult to maintain, too problematic, and too costly. And the second was the tendency to fight tooth and nail for them. David Edgerton, in his really top-notch, brilliant, fantastic book, The Rise and Fall of the British Nation, argues that after the Second World War, an imperial nation had died away, a nation based on free trade and the British Empire. And a new sense of national identity, based not around imperial connections and pride and that sort of thing, but around a sense of Britishness, emerged instead. And so this argument by David Edgerton helps to explain a little bit about why successive British governments were less concerned with holding on to imperial territories, because clearly there were fewer and fewer votes to be won in it. The age of music hall jingoism was a thing of the previous century, and the sense of connection that many ordinary British people had with their empire was fairly minimal. And this is perhaps as a result of the transformative experiences of the Second World War. These three territories in particular, which were federated in January 1953, in a sort of a curious hybrid kind of state-building project, which nobody is quite clear what the motivating factors behind it were. Were barely in the thoughts or the imaginings of most British people. There were few people who could point to where Nyasaland was on the map. As so often happens in colonial Africa, the decision to fuse different countries and peoples together against their own wishes created nothing but tensions. The colonial governors in Rhodesia and Nyasaland said it was a bad idea. The federation lasted a decade before crashing and burning into a constitutional crisis, and eventually a separation. Anger and resentment over the demise of the federation was strongest amongst the white settlers in southern Rhodesia. And by 1963, they were considering their own rebellion against domination from a Westminster government that they believed would eventually betray them and hand the country over to black majority rule. And certainly, when conservative rule ends in 1964, white colonial settlers have no faith that Harold Wilson's Labour government would act in their interests. Which, again, I find actually an unrealistic summation of affairs. Harold Wilson was somebody who believed in most of the standard dogma of British nationalism. He had as many misgivings and as many kind of favoured thoughts about the empire as most of the conservatives did. A figure of the radical left, he certainly was not. A figure of third world emancipation, he certainly was not. Ironically, though, it was the white colonial settlers in the Central African Federation who managed to poison the well of the Federation's politics. Martin Thomas writes, "During the CAF's 10-year existence, meaningful reforms were withheld from black Africans, while at the same time the white settler minority, and especially those in southern Rhodesia, consistently the most intransigent nationalist constituency in Central Africa, was shamelessly placated. Southern Rhodesia contained by far the largest settler population of these federated territories, close on 200,000, next to Nyasaland's 9,000 and northern Rhodesia's 70,000. The majority of southern Rhodesia's whites were neither wealthy farmers nor civil servants, but skilled workers. Their employment prospects and economic status were threatened by the Africanisation of local industry. In northern Rhodesia, whose all-important copper belt was dominated by three part British-owned mining conglomerates, company interest in promoting opportunities for their African labour force clashed with the preferential status once accorded to white mine workers through the industry colour bar. To be sure, post-war British governments had diminished means to restrain settler demands, whether in the labour market or in matters of politics or cultural privilege."
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Colonial governors wielded executive power in northern Rhodesia, Nyasaland. But southern Rhodesia had been internally self-governing since 1923. Its model of white rule, based on a narrow franchise and a firm grip on the levers of local economic power, was always liable to spread to its two neighbours once the federation took shape. Confusion persisted over the divisions of responsibilities between Britain, the three territorial administrations, and the new federal authorities, even so. Defence, for example, was a federal matter. Policing remained in the hands of individual territorial governments, and the British government maintained direct interests in both. These overlapping jurisdictions would cause intense friction between all sides from 1958 onwards, as the choice between oppression or conciliation of the African majority in all three federated territories became urgent. Much clearer was that the apparatus of federal government would be settler-built and settler-led. Once established, the Federation enjoyed lawmaking powers, British ministers and Whitehall officials scrutinising legislation, but not initiating it. There was a profound sense from the settlers that London didn't understand and that the British government had no sense of Africa in the way that they did. Although they were obviously speaking in a colonial sense about Africa, with all its biases and assumptions about and racial assumptions about what an orderly colonial society looks like, and there was a complicating factor of white Afrikaner immigration into Rhodesia from South Africa, or into the Central African Federation from South Africa. The Federation government was able to control and to cream off a significant amount of wealth from the copper mining industry and to control the crucial railways that held the capital cities together. And this, in the eyes of the settlers, gave them a viable future state, one where they would have the resources and the wealth to go their own way if they needed to, and particularly to go their own way if they needed to ensure their own supremacy within the Central African Federation or whatever successor states came after it. And that supremacy was what they sought to protect, and they didn't believe that Westminster was a useful ally in that struggle. And certainly they hadn't throughout the 1950s got clear messages from their own governments that that was something that was at the top of the British government's list of priorities. All they had seen is imperial retreat after imperial retreat, and they imagined that they would eventually be abandoned and left to their fate. Far better, they thought, to break away, and this is particularly in southern Rhodesia, to break away, to form a white settler state, a white colonial settler state, before black majority rule was imposed upon them by London. This isn't to say that the values of all of the colonialists in Africa were aligned with, say, the apartheid state in South Africa. Some who believed in the right of whites to rule in the Central African Federation still looked with shock and disgust at the extreme policies of the apartheid regime in South Africa, whilst perhaps being unreflective about their own diminishment of black African aspirations in the Central African Federation. They saw their version of white rule as a more moderate, more acceptable and less extreme version than that which they saw to the south of them. So the Federation, which failed fairly rapidly, had been feted in London as being a good idea. And a whole tranche of British journalistic, political and intellectual life supported it, and a broad spectrum of elite opinion thought it was a good concept. The reason why is that in the eyes of its British backers, far from making interracial conflict more likely, the Federation offered some kind of middle way. This is a kind of obviously breathtakingly naive between racial authoritarianism of the South African model and the surrender of Britain's Central African interests to black nationalist politicians themselves. So the Central African Federation offered a more gradualist route to some kind of racial harmony. The idea that racial harmony in a white settler colonial society is likely to be possible was a kind of, again, a breathtaking naivety, and perhaps a reassuring fiction that the British told themselves in order to distinguish their empire with other overtly racialized states, such as apartheid South Africa, such as the recently defeated Nazi Germany, and the story of a kind of a benign British Empire is told in such ways. Eventually, moderate African representatives, African politicians, would be elected, and there would be a sharing of power. By moderate, what that meant was that African politicians who knew that their choices were limited and that they were required to toe the line with white colonial and commercial interests. These are the political figures who would make it and who would be able to sit alongside white colonial settlers and determine a degree of policy. This would be the British vision of racial harmony. And the conservative governments of the day were very keen on ensuring that this came to pass. Of course, it's the colonial settlers who have most invested in blowing this dream apart. From the very outset, Southern Rhodesian settler leaders exploited the apparatus of federal rule to weaken countervailing British authority and also, therefore, to ensure continuing white supremacy. For them, the Federation was the prelude to and the means to transform its component territories into a white-governed dominion, a Greater Rhodesia, whose racial policies would approximate South African standards, not British. So there's a lot to unpack there. The long-term strategy of the Southern Rhodesian white settlers was to capture the Federation, and to mould it to a kind of a white supremacist state, far more so than it already was, and to allow South Africa, apartheid South Africa, to be the model for this new racial future. The British would be gradually outwitted and outmaneuvered in Southern Africa, and indeed they were. The various successive British governments were no match for the Southern Rhodesian white settlers, creating a dominion within the Commonwealth, within the Empire, and then eventually within the Commonwealth, was a desirable goal. So creating something akin to, say, Australia in terms of kind of legal status, and with the social and racial injustices of South Africa was the model that they were aspiring towards. If this wasn't achievable, then independence on white colonial terms would be sought after. The Central African Federation's checkered history was never going to be boiled down to simply a two-way fight between settler reactionaries and British liberal reformers. On the one hand, you have African nationalist groups, including Southern Rhodesia's African National Congress, Joshua Nkomo's Breakaway Zimbabwean African People's Union, and the northern cousin, the Zambian African National Congress, led by Harriet Nkambala and Kenneth Kaunda. They rejected cooperation on principle. Each proved their ability to govern through quite extraordinary patience in the face of provocation and repression. And on the other hand, the Westminster politicians, who were mainly on the conservative right, a small clique who sympathised with white settlers and believed that they were not only the rightful owners of the land, not only now abandoned by Great Britain, or going to be abandoned by Great Britain, but also, and here is where kind of the politics of colonialism are flipped on their head for all sorts of kind of disingenuous reasons, that the white Rhodesians would become the oppressed minority within the Central African Federation unless the Conservative Party stuck by them. And there was also a kind of an attempt to conflate black African nationalism with Bolshevik communist or Soviet infiltration, which is a story for another time. Anyway, there we must finish, and we will continue this journey into looking at the Central African Federation and its demise in forthcoming podcasts. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you all on the Explaining History podcast next time. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.